Hello and welcome back to Millennial 8. I think this is the 12th night now. Let me just check. Yes, it is. And I've got four streams for you tonight. In 2 hours from now, it'll be Nomos Events, then Censored Anon, and then Asha Logos. But first, it's Not on the Beeb, and specifically Mark Plain from Not on the Beeb. So welcome, Mark, to Millennial.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Would you like to introduce yourself and then Not on the Beeb to the audience, for those who haven't heard about it?
I'm kind of author, filmmaker, low level stuff. But, I've been trained in those areas. I was at a kind of film school, so kind of quite media savvy. And for years, from probably 2014, I started getting quite heavily involved in medical activism over some deep experience with someone, close to me suffering from cancer. So did the old classic kind of deep dive, which you do in that situation. And, it kind of continued. And I was always I was the keyboard warrior, social media activist until the pandemic started. And as it was kind of coming up, we could kind of, like many people, we could see kind of what was starting to happen. We could see all the censorship closing in for the 4 years, probably before the Facebook kind of fact checkers coming out and, the adverts all around London. So you could see them all closing in. And from my perspective, within the kind of vaccine damage awareness community, we could kind of see the push with the flu jab and how it was just accelerating. And we had a kind of a feeling something big was happening. It was, everything was converging to some sort of point. And then, of course, as soon as the pandemic started, in kind of early January, I put kind of one famous post up on Facebook, here we go. Because you could just see the fingerprints of what was being led into it. And of course, like everyone else, I was shocked and really not quite sure what to make of it in the first month or so. But very quickly, things were unraveling very, very quickly within the community. And the amount, the people effort behind everything to kind of unravel the data, the figures, And the point where I kind of realised where we were is when I just did a simple mathematical sum and kind of entered in what was going on in China and kind of realised that getting in a car in China was more dangerous than COVID. There's more, road traffic accidents. It was more dangerous to get on a motorbike, put a helmet on, get on a bike. And, the first kind of protests in London, they were starting off in kind of Hyde Park 50 people ago. But things, as it kind of came into the summer, we were ramping up. It was kind of taking over my life. First of all, kind of the activism is kind of 50% and 60%. And then by the 8th of, August, I remember the date specifically, it was like, I know too much about this. I understand too much with all the years I've been in the medical side. And I've got to go full-time now, whether I like it or not. So I dropped all my normal work and became full-time on the 8th. And the 8th of August, but it was the real turning point. And I think this is a turning point for many, many people, was on the 29th of August, 2020. We had the first major protest in London in Trafalgar Square. I'm not sure, did you go there? Were you kind of involved in that?
No, I didn't go to it, but I was observing it all, and I knew various people who were attending and helping with it. So
So that was kind of the big kind of turning point, because that was, up until that point, it was all very lonely voices. A lot of people kind of very scared, and there was other points for speaking out, but we were kind of very isolated. We, that was the whole point of the everyone was locked down, wasn't it? Keeping everyone away. But at that meeting in Trafalgar Square, you had, they estimate, the organisers said kind of there was 30,000. I kind of think it was more like 14,000. But it doesn't matter. The square was packed with, at that time, everyone was still wearing masks and scared. And you had, you had thousands of people there who were joyous, celebrating. Everyone was hugging each other. No one, there was no fear. And it was an incredible moment. And at that, moment, I was asked to film it. So I sold my camera equipment. I had a mobile phone. So I pulled out my mobile phone and there was a thing called live stream on Facebook. And I've never done one of these before. The day before, I kind of went and had a chai in my Indian cafe and kind of just did a test and just tapped to see what happened on this if you press this button for live on Facebook, and all my friends started talking to me, and it was like, oh, okay, waving. I was like, all right, this seems to work. So I turned up at the event, pressed live on my mobile phone. Someone put me in contact with the Highwire, Del Bigtree and the Highwire, and at this point there'd been no protests in America, so silence. They were fascinated to see what was going on in London. This was kind of the first gathering of the people breaking all the coronavirus act rules and meeting. And anyway, long short of it, you know, by the end of that evening, 29,000 people had watched the feed on my Facebook thing. And I was like, hang on, Alan, this is brilliant. Because this is, you know, if it's the organizing numbers are right, 30,000, this has doubled it with my mobile phone. There was plenty of other people doing it. But then the Highwire took it. And within a few days, got like 1.4 million views. And I was like, right. And they kind of said, by the way, what are you called? This kind of media unit working out of Britain. And I was like, it'd become a catch line of mine when I was putting kind of social media posts up saying, as not seen on the Beeb, you know, you won't see this on the BBC. And I just kind of, not on the Beeb. And it was like, and it got branded immediately like that. And of course, at that point, you know, we all hit the ground running, and there was the next protest on the 16th of September, then the 19th of September, then 28th, you know, and everything was rolling. The police were coming in on their horses, breaking up all the protests, and was just right in the middle doing all the live filming, you know, right in the middle. And yeah, that was not on the Beeb launched. And the other kind of amazing thing at this point is that this, you know, like we all faced at the time was losing friends. So those of us who were speaking up in 2020 and had this, our opinion of this is a scam, we're being had, this is a plan, it's probably a bioweapon, although kind of now see probably, you know, way more that it's actually the vaccine's the bioweapon. But we, you know, we were all losing friends. We were all kind of, you know, families were getting divided, friendship groups were getting divided. And, you know, I lost a hell of a lot of friends. But at that moment, I went, that Facebook Live, within 5-6 days, I've maxed out at the 5,000 new friends. And then all the followers grouped up. And suddenly there was this great new community. And instead of not fearing going on Facebook, you know, I was like, you know, I didn't care. But kind of that kind of feeling in my stomach of, all right, here we go. Fight, yeah, trepidation of like, who's going to say what now? Who's going to come at me for my throat? Suddenly there's kind of, you know, 5,000, 10,000 people following. And it was like, we had this kind of community and we're all kind of linking up friends and everyone else was doing it. And suddenly we're like, there's a whole group of us. And, you know, very quickly we're saying for every kind of friend I'd lost, I'd made 5 new ones. It was brilliant. It was absolutely fantastic. And, you know, yeah. No looking back, and it's been joyous since, really, with this new community. You know, the friends met, the doctors met, the scientists, and it's kind of the stuff done with Not on the Beeb. And I've been running to, you know, I had no intention to set up and become a podcaster. I had no intention to set up and become new media. My intention was to set up and fight the propaganda on whatever level could. So, and this was just the vehicle for it. But with this vehicle, suddenly been interviewing kind of doctors that I used to read about, and just kind of it was great to read their books and suddenly kind of being able to interview them, and the same with different experts and people coming through to me who didn't want to be named, suddenly having chats on the call. You know, I had called, you know, one of the calls was a kind of special branch anti-terrorist squad, and I was like, well, you know, you get that on the phone, and it's like, no, Mark, it's great, your work's brilliant, we all totally agree with you. It's like, so this, you know, talk about opening new doors. It was like fantastic, you know. And, so that's where it's kind of gone. You know, been making loads of films, doing loads of articles, and just kind of running as fast as I could to keep up. But probably the last few months, being able to take it a bit quieter, because I think what we got, I'm calling it the second wave now. Like, we were at the front, we were the pioneers pushing out, but now you've got all the people on a new stage. You know, Dr. Malone was one of the first ones to come out, but, you know, you've got a Asim Malhotra and all the rest of it, and even what's the nurse's name? Who's doing all the YouTube, really famous, what's he called, the doctor?
John Campbell.
Yeah.
Campbell.
But John Campbell. But he was the voices against that we were fighting, but now he's just kind of repeating what we were saying kind of a year and a half ago, and suddenly finding the data we were all throwing him a year and a half, 2 years ago. So that second wave is all kind of coming forward now. So in many ways, just kind of standing back and just watching where it's going, hearing this echo, and then in a slight bit of amusement, kind of seeing where it's going, what they're not talking about. So what is kind of interesting now is, you know, we you know, the some people say what we did is extreme, but, you know, if saying what's in the calling the vaccine a bioweapon and talking about the transhumanism angle is not extreme when you can pick up a magnet and it sticks to somebody over the injection spot. It's not when it sticks to them over the chest. And we went out, filmed it. We proved it. I took doctors out there. So that element is not being talked about. Although we're talking about, everyone's talking about, it's a fact, or it's a dodgy medical product that shouldn't have been released.
Well, so that's the question, isn't it? I mean, there's a lot to pick up on in what you've said.
Yeah, sorry.
It's fine. I guess the big question here is, obviously there are problems with the vaccine. I think that's completely undeniable at this point. Now, just to summarize my own history with COVID, I thought at first I was sort of watching, like, from, I think, January, February. I think I first heard about it in February. And so February and March, I was just sort of watching and thinking, well, not many people seem to be dying from this. And it's in China. It seems to be mostly old people. It doesn't seem to be a big deal. Then suddenly our governments and authorities in the West suddenly started taking it very seriously, very seriously. And they were saying lockdown. And so then I thought, okay, I must have been wrong. There must be more to it than I can see. And that remained for about a month, but maybe 2 months, but definitely by the middle of May, I was thinking, something's wrong here. Something's going on here. It doesn't seem to add up. And at this point, the borders weren't closed. You didn't have to wear the mask in supermarkets, but they were suggesting it. I think they had it mandated in some places. And so all these people were still coming into the country and traveling all over the world. And I thought, surely if there is a serious pandemic, you're getting people to stay in their homes. So why are you letting people travel all over the world? It just doesn't seem to make sense. There are these various contradictions. And then I think in the June of 2020, the BLM riots started and protests and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that they didn't discourage that. Yeah. And that was when I thought, okay, that this has to be, there's something very strange is going on here. And of course, the difficulty with grappling with it was how massive the thing must be. By definition, it's like, this isn't some small mistake that's been made. It can't be. This must be huge. And so you think, for a long time, I was skeptical. It can't be, because it would. If this is a lie, then it's a massive lie. If this is a deception, then it's a massive deception. It's unlike anything I've ever seen in my life. It was hard to accept. But I don't know when I really, like, fully was just on the anti-COVID side, when I probably June. But also the other thing that would happen in the May was Klaus Schwab appeared as a public figure. That was when I first saw this face, the ominous face.
Star Trek uniform.
and saying that we're never going back to the world that we knew eight weeks ago. Normal. Yeah, we're going to build back better. That started then. And so I thought, right, this is some kind of scam. And then, of course, the difficulty then is working out what is the scam. Obviously, the virus is nowhere near as dangerous as they're saying, but they're getting everyone to behave in a way as if there is a plague going on. They're getting everyone very scared. They're locking everyone down. So that has all sorts of psychological repercussions there, but also economic repercussions. I think everyone knows a shop or something that's shut down, maybe multiple ones. Mm-hmm. So a place that I particularly really cherished in Edinburgh is gone now. It was there all my life. It's gone now. But then the economic impact more broadly is just the economy's pulverized by this. So all of that. And then, so the question is, why? And some people would say, well, it's simple profit. They're making an absolute fortune from the vaccine itself. So they're getting everyone scared so that everyone will want to get the vaccine. So they're making a fortune from the vaccine, but also a lot of these small businesses have just, it's like a massacre of small businesses. And the resulting vacuum is then occupied by huge corporations. So what would you say about all of that?
That was one long answer gets another long answer. Where do you just, because I don't know you personally, where do you stand on what you think happened with 9/11?
I actually don't really have an opinion on 9/11, but I suspect that the official narrative is probably bullshit. Just because it seems to be that there are enough people who are skeptical about it, who have looked, spent a long time looking into it, that I think there must be something wrong. I don't know what exactly. I don't really believe that the planes were holograms or whatever. I suspect that the I don't know about that, but I suspect that it was controlled demolition of some kind. But I don't know. I wouldn't want to swear to it. I simply don't know enough about it. I feel it's my part. I should know more about it than I do.
Okay, that well, it's a good question because that illuminates much. But I got when the planes hit, because I've been involved in this sort of thinking for many, many years. So when the planes hit, I was just like, my first reaction was, I'm going to catch them, as in the scam. And I ran as the first tower got hit. I ran out of my living room, down to local town, got a five pack of a VHS video, ran back up the hill, kind of sweating like anything, got the old VHS recorder and just put them in and put them on long play and pressed record. So I got the first 24 hours because I was like, I'm going to find the mistake in it, because it was just, I thought this doesn't smell right immediately. It was just the hallmark of a organised event. And then, of course, and then since then, I've become heavily involved in researching it and got pretty strong conclusions to how it was done. But what's really interesting, and this goes back, the reason I asked that is what you said, was you talked about the scale. What surprised you was the scale of the pandemic. And one of the biggest things that people come up with 9/11 is like, well, how did you organise that? The amount of people you need, people just get this logistic, even taking people right to the edge of realizing, understanding what happened. And they go, no. It needed thousands of people and one of them would have talked. And that's basically kind of the argument. But when you can see that these things are pulled off by very few people and the way that the silence is kept, it's good learning. It was good learning for this one. So this one is, this is huge. Like you said, it's world scale, off scale. But that was the biggest magic show we'd ever seen before, and it was a televised magic show that fooled the world. So this is just on another scale. And also, your other part of it, you mentioned why? What's the motive? Is it just to scare a lot of people to sell vaccines? But what you can see with 9/11, this is also the beauty. When I come up with a good plan with my friends, it always works on multiple levels. If we work out an idea, it could be good for me, it's good for you, and it's good for the other person we're going to hook in. We're all going to benefit from it in some sort of way. And that's how you could see it with 9/11. There was multiple reasons, from insurance on the building to getting rid of important files to clearing away things that didn't want to be there, to creating a scare, to create a war, the war in the Middle East that they wanted. It was multiple levels. And all the people came part and they all had their way of different gaining. And that's how this has worked. So it's working for multiple people, multiple levels. How is it working for China? How is it working for the World Economic Forum? How is it working for each of the government heads? The people in Britain, those ministers have made all the big decisions, just made millions themselves just by selling paper napkins to put around your face. Because they all allowed their little kind of bit in. So everybody had their kind of benefit coming from it. But what's the ultimate aim? is, you know, I think, you know, I don't think we can get away from the depopulation stance. And also, this is the other thing, is like I said, mentioned before when I started, is we could see something was coming. And one of the things, have you ever heard of Deagle.com, the website? Are you aware of that?
No, I haven't.
Okay, well, there's this website called Deagle.com. And of course, it's just the website. Who runs it and is it important or anything else? But it's a very impressive website called Deagle.com that basically lists every country around the world, and it lists all the data of that country. And it's like military-based, so it literally lists how many soldiers they've got, how many rifles, ammunition, tanks, planes, helicopters, missiles, everything. And then it predicts into the future. And it also predicts the economy, the level of the economy, the GDP, everything like that, average wage, all the kind of data for country. But it also predicts the population. And what got highlighted amongst certain circles as we were looking at it about 4 years before, I can't remember, I think it was 2015, 2016. And you could see this massive dip in the population in Britain, in America, in Europe. A massive dip, like two-thirds. And we're all going, what the hell is going on? And I remember just looking at it, and we didn't have any idea what it is. But I started looking at all the countries around the world, just trying to gauge what could be happening in these countries that's not happening in those countries, and also the economy being devastated in the West. And the basic conclusion was, is the basic what the website was showing was that the white Western countries, North America, America, Canada, the whole of Europe, Australia, were all going to be decimated, but all the other countries were not going to be. And what we've got linking up now and matching, which is the horrific kind of thing, is the countries with the high vaccination rates in Europe, America, Canada do link in with that. So that's quite terrifying. It's quite terrifying. And, you know, the website the people who ran the website, they pulled all the data. They tried to claim it was just a volunteer website, which is a load of rubbish. But of course, people were so mortified by what's seen. Everyone screenshot it. They saved it. It was saved in internet archives. It's all been pulled up, so the information's still there. So, yeah, is it depopulation? I think we can see. We've got the medical proof. You know, we've published it on Not on the Beeb. The vaccine went straight for the ovaries. It went straight for the testes. And birth rates dropped. We've seen that already.
You know, and stillbirth skyrocketed as well.
Stillbirth skyrocketed, yeah. And even, you know, I just got a message from a friend in Brazil, and I love these fractals. And there's a community in southern Brazil, a small area of a couple of thousand people, a couple of main doctors, but everybody knows everybody. And the message I got coming back from a friend who's got family there was the local doctor has told her with heart problems and everything else, yeah, it's the vaccine. Also turned around and warned her not to get pregnant and said, from all the data he'd seen, not to do anything. But he was also told, as I said, wow, that doctor's brave. And he went, no, he's not brave, because in that community, if he'd lied to anybody in that community, it's like old cowboy territory, they would have come and shot him. So that doctor has to be honest. He's there, he's valued, but he'll be shot if he tries to pull any kind of fast tricks. He's a doctor speaking the truth to his people, because they'll kill him before pharmaceutical companies or anybody else. And it's a small outlying bit in Brazil. But I think that's what's going to happen over the rest of the world slowly, is people are going to speak up and wake up and see what's been going on. But where does it go from there? Because that's quite a crazy point. You know, when we first, just before I hand it back to you, when I first found the magnetism, I went to one of the protests in London and were proving the magnetism. And I met up with a lot of ex-retired police who were meeting in Hyde Park. And when they said, my God, look what you've proven. What do you think? And I said, I don't know. I said, but I think you guys are going to be busy, because when the public find out what's happened to them and what's been done to them, the protection they're going to need is forever. And there's going to be lynch mobs going out. And then the police said, yeah, we know. So, but that's the point we're going to get to, is, you know, how are the public going to react when they find out what's been done to them, when there's a mass awakening on that level?
Yeah, this is something that I wonder about as well. And, you know, it's possible. I wondered if the Ukraine war, and then the climate change thing, these might be new things to distract the public so that they don't fixate on the vaccine. I don't know. That might be a sort of hope on the part of the powers that be, that well, we'll just keep them busy with, you know, being cold through the winter or being starving or something. So then they won't have time to think about what happened 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago.
And make it irrelevant. And make it irrelevant. That's the other thing, you know. And I tell you, well, I've forgotten an important thing because I kind of predicted it. You know, you say you started your show in 2014, but I had a, you know, it's about 2013 when I did a deep dive into the financials because, you know, I'd suffered badly in the last financial crash, you know, losing a business and losing my home and losing many other things. And I was fascinated because what had happened, I'd seen how corrupt the banks were. And I was still researching them. And it was about 2013, I kind of learned what fiat currency was and did that deep dive, realizing that our financial system was absolutely shot to pieces and was bankrupt. And once I realized the extent of that debt, and because I'd also come out of being in debt, or I'd been gone through the debt and kind of bankrupted the business and everything, I knew how that kind of process works and how you fight it and how you can't fight it off in a certain level. And I was looking at the debt Britain's in and America going, you can't get out of that. So no matter how hard you try, you're stuck. And then I just crossed my arms thinking about it. And I was like, and this fiat money thing, what a scam, you know, lending money you haven't got and out of thin air. Like, and I was like, there's only two ways out of this. One is to put your hands up and say, look, we've messed up. But that will bring the lynch mobs out again because the devastation would be terrible. So then I was like, and the only other option they've got is to pull a magician's trick. So they've got to wave the white hanky in one hand so violently that no one notices what the other hand's doing, you know, robbing the pocket and everything else. And, you know, when I was asked at the time what I thought that could be, I was like, the only hanky that could be that distracting, you know, the way the magician's hanky would be, is to stop people realizing what's happening with the economy being swapped, is a nuclear war. So I kind of predicted maybe that's what they're going to have to do, is they're going to push for a nuclear war with Iran. And then they'll redo the economy under that. So, of course, when the pandemic came across, I was like, oh, wow, oh, this never saw this one coming. This is really clever. But yeah. Then you see the levels of then they're going to war and then they're bringing in the climate lockdowns and everything else.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I wouldn't say that it has to be something as drastic as a nuclear war because all you need is people to be scared, really scared and worried. And then they'll be malleable. They'll be obedient and they'll look for leadership. They'll look for secure, any stability. Something like COVID, if they'd pushed it a bit further, you know, I think people would have been hysterical quite easily. And definitely, again, with the resource shortages, all through COVID, you know, and this is something I've said before, people were inconvenienced by COVID, by the lockdowns and all that. But basically, comfort remained throughout the whole thing. People were still warm. They still had electricity. They still had running water. They still had Wi-Fi. They still had food.
They had money in their banks. They had money in their banks because they're all getting their furlough money.
And that as well. As well. So, you know, if you really wanted to mess, it was more of a psychological thing. But if you really wanted to mess them up, you would take away all of that stability. Then I think they would become much more pliable. A depopulation could be one part of that. It could be one version of that. But I also think that climate change, I mean, they're not letting go of that. And actually something that you might remember, because you've been involved with this stuff for as long as I have or more, I remember that climate change was in the 90s, they called it global warming and the ozone layer and all that. Then and before that, it had been global cooling, but we won't talk about that. Then it was climate change in the 2000s. And it started, I don't know when exactly, about 2004 or 5, peaking in 2007. And then the global financial crisis happened. And they dropped climate change. It just stopped. I remember politicians were talking about greening the economy and things like that. It was all over the place in 2007. And then suddenly it was nowhere because the financial crisis hit and people had much more real, proximate things to worry about. And so I think the powers that be realize, okay, they're not going to be interested in climate change. We can't get them to worry about this. They've got other things to worry about now. And then it came back a few years later. And that was when that awful Richard Curtis film, No Pressure. Do you remember that? It was this terrible, terrible propaganda film that they did. It's a short film that's supposed to be a, sort of funny, but it was people would cause someone else to blow up if that other person wasn't on board with the climate change agenda. And so they'd just press a button and the person would explode. I mean, it was sick, actually. It was meant to be funny, but it just came across as very mean-spirited and macabre. But anyway, so that was the start of it coming back. And all through the 2010s, the climate change thing was bigger. Then COVID happened. But then climate change didn't go away. When the global financial crisis hit, climate change went away. But when COVID happened, climate change didn't go away. They kept it going. They kept it going all through the lockdowns and all of that. And they're still talking about it now. And I find that very interesting as a contrast. They let up on climate change 10 years ago. Now they don't. It's like they want people, they're not giving people that ability to escape from it, to forget about it. I think they want it to be in people's minds all the time. What would you say about that?
I've got something to admit on this, because I've got a bit of a connection to the climate story, because when it first came out, called Greenhouse, it was Greenhouse Warming, wasn't it? That's what they first called it in the 80s. I made a film. I was a student filmmaker, and I kind of won a national award with a film talking about greenhouse gases. And this is before the internet, anything. Didn't have a clue. Just believed everything. Of course, believed everything. And then through, you know, the 90s, I still saw it as a very, very important cause. And it was also very linked to environmentalism, just like looking after the planet. And I got the idea of making a second film using the same actors from 1988, because one of them had become famous, you know, John Thompson, the comedian, who works with Alan Partridge, used to work with Alan Partridge. And I shot that film 2015, the second part. And for about, when they first brought in, you know, I still believed the whole thing. But then when they were hijacking the story, I don't know, I still see it as a hijacking of the genuine movement. I still see it as that, but maybe it was seeded and it was false all the way from the very, very beginning, because I don't know about the ozone or specifically. But when they brought in the, started talking about carbon credits, I was like, hang on, you can't start trading, you're financialising a crisis and you're going to trade something that's a value. It's kind of like, you know, if I've got plastic bags in the supermarket, if I don't save three or something, I'll swap them with you and you can use more plastic bags. Well, you can't do anything like that.
It's like the papal indulgence thing.
Yeah. Well,
it's ridiculous.
It's crazy, but I kind of, and it's interesting when I look at how I was thinking, because I think this is where a lot of people are now still, who are kind of got one eye kind of waking, you know, looking at it going, hang on. But then I was like, you know what, I'm going to keep going on this, still pushing it, because the environmental side is really, really important. And even if we're being hoodwinked or used on one angle, the overall picture is still looking after the environment, and that's good. And it got through to making a film in 2015, and I did some research coming up to it, and I was just suddenly like, oh my God, no, this is worse than I thought. We've been totally, totally, totally had. So right in the middle of making the film, as we were shooting it, I literally changed the meaning to try and let people know that I've now realised that we've been scammed. But my goodness,
wow.
Me, that's too... So yeah, I've been involved in it from kind of the beginning all the way through. And then ironically, I was right next to here by the COP in Egypt. I was just kind of around the periphery of this event. And I was watching all the Greenpeace people here and everything else, and you could just see how really interesting how set it is and how single focused they are. I thought I was going to have some conversations with them about kind of just CO2. I thought I might just talk to them like, why is CO2 really bad? Because, you know, why do they put CO2 into greenhouses so plants grow bigger if it's such a bad thing? Because all that's going to happen is the world, if we produce more carbon dioxide, plants are going to grow bigger because there's going to be a homeostatic response. The plants are going to grow bigger to absorb the carbon dioxide because the world wants to keep everything balanced. But when I saw these people here, I was like, nah, not worth speaking to anybody. They're so set and focused and on this passionate drive. There's nothing can do. And that was an eye-opener for me to see how these agendas are fed out to people with good intention who then become kind of religiously,
yes,
determined to pull off good for humanity. All good people thinking they're doing their best.
Oh yeah, and you know, I want to be clear, I don't like pollution. You know, I don't like wasting resources. I think that everything should be recycled that can be. You know, I absolutely don't. I mean, pollution, you know, who on earth could think that it's all right, it's fine? Obviously, we should be looking after the environment. And, you know, I applaud anyone who devotes themselves to that. I think it's a very laudable thing to care about the environment, to devote yourself to protecting the planet. I can see the romance and the obsession that people, I can understand it. I definitely can understand it. And I think it's a shame that the politics of all of that has really been taken by crazy leftists and allied to all sorts of other crazy notions instead of being something that everyone cares about. I mean, and you know, this is a problem on the right. I think that historically the right has just left all of that stuff alone and sort of seen it as hippie nonsense. It's not hippie nonsense. It's just, you know, once upon a time, conservatives, Tolkien, for example, you know, that kind of thing, would have absolutely cared about the environment. And I think it's only sensible and sane and virtuous as well, in the real way. So, yeah, I just want to underline, I'm not against looking after the environment at all. It's what's been done with it. It's the politicization, the weaponization of that drive that I find insidious and quite evil. Let me ask you about this. We've talked about several different deceptions. We've talked about at least three, 9/11, COVID, and climate change. And I guess the fiat currency as well. The problem, and this gets to the name of your channel, the name of your project. The problem is that people necessarily rely on the news in their country, the news system of their society. And the BBC, because some of my viewers aren't British, quite a lot of them aren't British. I think everyone's heard of the BBC. I think everyone knows broadly what it is. But what foreigners might not understand is the romantic place that it occupies in British people's hearts. The BBC used to be called Auntie and the Beeb, affectionate nicknames for this thing, the British Broadcasting Corporation. And even the acronym BBC, it's sort of etched into people's minds. What would you say about all of that? Because it's something that people want to trust. It's something that people have affection for. They want to have affection for it because it's a national institution and all of that. And they think most people, I think, still believe that the BBC is telling them the truth every day. It's pumping. It's just constantly working to help them understand their world.
I love your description because it was very passionate and you were absolutely accurate, because I think British people see the BBC as quintessentially British. It's kind of exactly what the nation is, and it's all about democracy, it's all about clarity, it's about telling the truth. And the perception people have is, you know, and we put the BBC out into other countries to let them know the truth because their nasty little governments are lying to them. We kind of fund this organisation to go out and kind of set the people free from being deceived and deception. And yeah, it's very, very, and we've also got that same idea of our democracy. So we think, you know, we send people to check the votes in other countries. It's always in the headlines. Oh, yeah, we sent a delegation out to some African country to assist in their voting to make sure it's all counted properly, because we do it properly. And we're going to show these kind of other people how to do it completely properly. And everyone starts to go, yes, because, you know, we're British and we've got this great organisational thing and trust, open, transparency, freedom and everything else. So, yeah, that is the perception of the BBC. And it's a very, very strong brand that people in other countries also kind of believe, because it's nurtured so well. And I started the Not on the Beeb thing, started for me when I started actually saying Not on the Beeb was during the Yellow Vest protests in France, because realised what was going on. There's this massive uprising and there was nothing on the BBC, not one word. And I was publishing like crazy, you know, getting all the videos in off of the activists, of the filmmakers, and just pushing them all out. And I think from memory, I can't remember precisely, I won't be quoted, but something like 14 weeks, the BBC stayed quiet, as in pretending that, you know, what's the distance from London to Paris? It's probably similar to London to Edinburgh or somewhere in Scotland. It's close.
Oh, yeah.
Paris is close. And it was denied. So then you become...
Just to interject briefly, it was exactly the same with the Dutch tractor protest this year.
Yeah.
The BBC, I actually looked, they've even got a specific page on the website, bbc.co.uk/news/Europe/Netherlands. There's a specific page for Dutch news, and there was no mention anywhere on the website.
No mention.
The Europe section, the Dutch section, the news section. Nothing about the Dutch tractor protest. Also the same with the Canadian convoy. They ignored it for
the freedom convoy.
Week.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they've gone crazy. So it's under a thing called a D notice. So all the media handed these D notices, and the D notices came from, I think it's the First World War, where it was basically saying, don't print that all the soldiers are moving up to the front. Don't print that there's big troop movements or tank movements going this way. So it's very sensible kind of stuff. If you know the enemy, you're going to read the newspaper and you can work out what's happening. But it's been overused, and it's become some sort of, you know, people fear it. It's feared within the media because they won't break it. They won't break when there's a D notice out. The media, the established media, the mainstream media, they won't break that rule at all. So that was out of doubt what was happening within the pandemic. So the protests, the reason I called it Not on the Beeb is we filled Trafalgar Square and not mentioned on the BBC. Yet they mentioned the protest that was happening on the same day in Berlin. And they called it a load of right-wing Nazi fascists, but without sending anybody there. You know, I've been there. It's just it's a wider section of society, just like the Iraq war protests were. It's just a little bit of everybody. But of course, the BBC said, oh, in Spain, it's all right-wing fascism as well. In Germany, it's this, it's Nazis to kind of... But in Britain, there was no protest. Their deception is off the scale. And to bring it down personally, and this was kind of the interaction we had with them, when I brought out the magnetism, put out the magnetism, okay, so we found out, you know, a neodymium magnet sticks to the point of injection. So started filming people. I mean, people were sending in videos. It was going crazy. I don't know who first discovered it. I think it was someone in South America where it first started. But it started getting viral. So we're collecting these videos together. We're picking up the magnets. We're going out and putting these films together. And the first reaction the BBC did was made, well, one, they got the fact checkers on us. They got Reuters on us. They got Full Fact Check UK. Went to go check them out, by the way. It's a, you know, Full Fact Check, fullfact.org. I think it is. They're based in Whitehall. I went and stood outside the buildings. You can just see it's part of the Whitehall thing. And you've got all these kind of faces, all the people work there. They don't work. There's no one working there. They're all working from home in some sort of office. But you can see it's a government-run operation. And, I mean, Reuters jumped in. And then the BBC jumped in and then made what they called a fact-check film on the magnetism. And it's the biggest pile of rubbish you've ever seen. Because all they did was interview all these people who, when they called them up, these experts, they said, will a magnet stick to your skin? Everyone's going, don't be so stupid. And, oh, this is what's in the vaccine. Just water and five types of lipid fat for the nanoparticles, for the lipid, you know, the liposomal technique. And all the experts are going, no, it's absolutely impossible for a magnet to stick. So they did all this, and they put this little film together. But the one thing they never did was pick up a magnet and try and stick it on somebody. They never tested it. So it was the most rubbish bit of propaganda you've seen. And you can see it on YouTube. And you can see everybody on YouTube underneath just calling it out, going, what a load of rubbish. So that's what they did. But then you can see the more, you can see how they work with the intelligence services. Because, I mean, they are connected. BBC is connected to intelligence services. It's part of the origin of the BBC. And people have told me that the intelligence services have offices inside BBC headquarters. So they actually control the news that's going on. And we know about Mockingbird, Operation Mockingbird, and how the CIA took over all the media organisations in America. But, you know, here we've just got the BBC is the mouthpiece of the military intelligence that drives the narrative in the country. But they put out a bit of news, and this is when I was like, you know, we're winning this, because they the best they could come up with is they said, the BBC said, we've gone to the NHS and we've now worked out that we need to ban neodymium magnets because they're a danger to small children from swallowing them. And when I saw right. that, I was like, is that the best you come up with? And it's like, and they said it wasn't even magnets, it was neodymium magnets. Now, 5 days before they pushed the article out, we were all learning, how do you say it, neodymium, not neo? But none of us, we were all trying to learn how to say the word neodymium. 4 days later, neodymium magnets are being banned because they're a danger to children. And we looked at the cases they pulled up, and there'd been someone in the hospital 3 years before who'd swallowed two. And you don't want to swallow the magnets, but your kids don't want to swallow them. But you could see how desperate they were to try and quell the story. That's the best they could come up with. But that, you can, when you see that kind of propaganda response, you see them responding to what we're doing, as in some sort of kind of like ping pong, then you can see what the BBC really is.
Yes.
One, they're pushing out a narrative. Second, they're defending it. And second, they're attacking the truth. Because what we were doing was the truth. We were asking the question, what is going on? We took doctors out with us, the magnet sticking, verify it, getting everyone to verify it, right? What is going on? Asking that question. So very sad for the big wake up, you know, it's the big wake up, the BBC. Well,
yeah, definitely. Can you explain the magnetic quality of the vaccine? Is that I heard about graphene. I don't know if that's involved. Some people thought it was at one point. What is that?
Well, okay, let's talk about what we know. Okay, let's just do what's definite. What have we tested that is 100% factual? I've stood outside when they did the mass vaccination purge surge thing at Twickenham Rugby Stadium. They had 15,000 allotments of vaccine there, and there were just queues of basically white 20 something year old students basically all queuing up to get their vaccine. We stood there, tested them coming out. Everyone we tested, the magnet stuck. Weekly, we were testing them about 15 minutes after, 20 minutes after they came out. They're all coming out and getting selfies with their kind of vaccination certificate, all posting it back on Facebook, all caught up in that kind of perfect propaganda snowball avalanche. When we tested them, 100%, and they all stuck. And I've got it on film. One lad, he did the most biggest favour for me in the world. He pushed his way through the crowd and went, test me. And I was testing him for ages, and people started tittering in the crowd, all laughing. And I was testing, moving, and I got a technique. And eventually I just stood back and put my hands up and said, can't find it. And he burst out laughing, goes, I had you, I fooled you. He goes, because I was never vaccinated. And then I was like... And I started laughing, and I started clapping, and I said, you've done me the biggest favour. That's my control. Okay? You've just done it. You've done it on camera. And you can see that I was genuinely trying to find it. I couldn't find it, and you've proven you're not vaccinated. You can see the trick. So there, people are vaccinated. People who had the Pfizer jab, mRNA jab, in boost in one or two, 100% that we were testing, were... straight after were magnetic. When we went to the park and tested people randomly, we had a few people who were not magnetic, but the vast majority were. We had people at AstraZeneca who didn't seem to be. So what we were figuring out, it was the mRNA vaccine. It's the Pfizer, it's the Moderna vaccines that are making people magnetic, not the AstraZeneca. It's a different technology. So we know that definitely. Then also the second part of what we know is when I say their magnetic injection point is very, very precise. Like it's right over the precise point of the vaccination. You know, go 1 inch high, it doesn't stick. Half an inch low, it doesn't stick. It'll fall away, the magnet. What we do know is then, with some people, in the weeks after and even months after, they then become magnetic around this part of the chest and this over here, around the nose and the sinuses, okay? So that's what we saw happening. And it the explanation for that is deeper and longer, but I'm going to skip that one just to establish that's what we know and go back to answer your question, which is why are people magnetic at the point of injection? So Dr. Campra, he broke it. It's his investigation. There's some other people in America, doctors have claimed they found it, but no, it's Dr. Campra in Spain who worked out that there's graphene, high probability of graphene flakes. He then did multiple testing in the months after to basically prove the likelihood of it being graphene. It's kind of very, 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 very high, as in the chances are. You know, it's still not proven 100%. So what these graphene flakes are single layers of carbon. So it's similar to the graphene when you've got pencil, but it's single layers of carbon atoms that make like a flake. And they're tiny little flakes. And as Dr. Andrew Goldsworthy, who I've been working with, fantastic gentleman, he's the guy who then worked out what was probably causing the magnetism. And he said, if these graphene flakes are there, they'll be act like razor blades. So in the same way that a piece of paper, even though it can fold and you can tear it, if you run it along your finger, you can slice yourself like a razor, okay, because it's thin. That's how the graphene flakes work. And he thinks they'll cut through the cell membrane. And because they're basically carbon-based, they'll create like a short circuit of the voltage. It's a micrometer. I can't remember the scale, but it's a tight... A very, very small voltage. In terms of where the cell is, it's a very high voltage. But when that's short-circuited by the graphene cutting through the cell, it will set up an electromagnetic field. And then what he also then said is once that electromagnetic field is set up, it will then snowball and actually infect other cells. So the magnetism will be increased. And of course, because it's magnetic, then it would interfere with many processes within the body, from heart rhythms to cellular function to just about everything. So it's not a joke. Very dangerous.
And so this would mean that vaccinated blood would be a dangerous thing to get transfused with.
It's the last thing you want in the world. Last thing you want in the world. You don't want that.
Yeah.
So we need independent blood banks. We were calling out for it a year ago, but there's been some recent cases with a baby in New Zealand highlighting and pushing it, which is absolutely fantastic. There's a young boy in America who died after his blood transfusion, and some very sad cases. But the story needs to be opened up. We need. It's going to happen. There's no way it's not going to happen. We need two lots of blood banks. We need non-vaccinated blood. We need to separate it, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Somebody has asked a question. Does a neodymium magnet stick to the syringe of the vaccine prior to it being injected into a person?
No. And it probably would because of the needle. The question is asking whether a drop of the vaccine would be magnetic. I think that's what's going to mean, because the needle is metal. Yeah. So the neodymium magnet is just basically a very, very strong magnet. It's a kind of a rare earth metal, so it's just much stronger than a normal magnet. So a neodymium magnet, the shiny little silver ones you often see people using on blackboards or on fridges to hold notes there. So it's just very, very, not the kind of matte black ones. It's the shiny little silver ones. Snap very easy if you drop them. No, it's kind of like it's not a magnetic particle. So the first thing we thought was there must be iron oxide. That's, you know, there must be something metallic inside the vaccine, but that's not the case. It's graphene, which by itself is not magnetic. But once it's cut through a cell, it becomes magnetic. And this is the other thing.
It becomes magnetic once it's...
Yeah.
Sorry, you go.
You need the magnet there to make it magnetic. So the magnet causes the magnetism in the other side there.
Yeah. Right, I see. And have you any idea why they would have put graphene flakes into the vaccine? Is that deliberate medical sabotage, or is it some sort of shortcut, some sort of convenience in the manufacturing process, or a
screw up? We found papers on it. There's hundreds and papers of multiple research on multiple medical products and vaccines where they've been adding graphene. One of the reasons for it is when graphene was invented or discovered or kind of basically marketed, there was a massive fund put into Europe. I think it's €1 billion or €500 million put into research. And when you put a lot of money into research, people try and find answers for what they can use graphene for. So there's this huge push to use, because graphene is basically seen as like the new silicon, is like one of these wonders.
Yeah, I remember about 10 years ago, it was being touted as the new silicon. So you'd be able to, because of how thin it is, you'd be able to make even smaller, even more dense structures with it, CPUs and so on.
So it's more, I think it's 30 times more conductive than copper and things like this. You know, it's a while since I've read the papers, but it's incredibly more conductive. So, but it's been used in multiple vaccines. All the papers are there of them trying to use it. You can see it in China, absolutely huge amount of papers being pumped out of the universities of graphene's been used in this vaccines and everything else. But your question was, why have they specifically used it? And this goes a hell of a lot deeper, you know, into what might be called the conspiracy side of it. But the push seems to be in the is transhuman. So how do you connect humans to technology? You know, we're flesh, we're biological, we're not magnetic. We don't respond to, we're not meant to respond in the same way as metals and normal things to kind of those forces. So making us more respond, well, I mean, we do respond to electromagnetic, everyone responds to frequency because we are frequency, all of our cells, all of our atoms and protons, everything's vibrating, everything's spinning in frequency, but we're essentially non-reactive. But if you can build that equipment, the aerials inside the body, which will pick up or accentuate the effect of electromagnetic waves, then you've got the ability to control an organism via frequency. So via electromagnetic waves, which could be transmitted or used from anywhere. And that is, you know, that's the cutting edge of where everything's going. So a very, very simple way to look at it is frequencies can be used to heal people, which is like the Rife technology. And there's all the cutting edge technologies coming out like this, from the quantum healing machines to the magic wands people are talking about now to everything else. But you can also use the frequencies, different frequencies, as a weapon. In the same way you can make a glass explode, an opera singer can make a glass explode with the same frequency, you can use frequencies to damage people or to heal them.
Right. Somebody asked whether you'd done experiments, the magnet experiment, with other vaccines, non-COVID related. But I guess that's covered already by what you said about it being used in a range of different vaccines.
Well, we haven't. The proper answer to that question is no, we haven't. But we know that the graphene's been used in some of the flu vaccines that started around 2019.
Right, okay. But, I think the last time I had a flu vaccine, I think, was 2011, something like that, 2012. Because I'm epileptic, so they offered it to me for some reason, just because I'm, you know, only mildly epileptic as well. But they just by default offered it to anyone who had any medical condition. They sent out a letter. So I thought, well, okay, I might as well get it, because it was back then.
Yeah. It seems like a nice freebie, and you're being looked after and cared for. And,
Yeah. And to be fair, I didn't get the flu that year. But I did get it the year before. And that was why, that was what motivated me. Because I thought, oh, yeah, I don't want to get that again. So, but yeah, that was a different age, though. Or I hope it was. I hope it was a different age. And I certainly didn't get the COVID vaccine.
Well, good. I'm sorry. And for anybody listening, you know, who has taken the vaccine and worried by things saying, kind of, the first thing to do is just not take any more. And you can always change your mind and have them later. But then the second thing to do is just to detox. And that's what you basically need to be doing. One, look after yourself. The second, detox. And there's various methods of doing that. We list them on the website. But you need to be cleaning your body out. And you need to be looking after yourself.
All right. Here's a question to end with. Do you think that they could do COVID again? You know, because it seems like this was a big manufactured hysteria, worry about a virus that really wasn't very dangerous. I think you had to be over 80 in order to have a 5% chance of dying from it. If you were under 80, it was progressively lower, such that I think if you were 50, you had 0.5% chance or something like that. Mm. And yet they shut the world down for it. Do you think they could do this again?
Well, okay, so here's the dark answer. When first was looking into the real numbers, so it's kind of like Easter going into the summer of 2020, and we started to realise how few people really were dying and how they were causing the excess deaths, probably using the midazolam in the old people's homes. They were actually just basically people. It was a succession of people ticking off boxes that caused old people to be injected with midazolam and just let go, basically. And that's how they're getting the excess deaths. So when we saw all of that and saw how literally undangerous this was with all those stats you just labelled, you know, that, and how they'd had to kind of lie, and you know, it was the basic lie of so it was going to go one step back to make it so how clear it was a deception was, you know, anybody who died within 28 days of getting COVID was listed as a COVID death. And before that 28 days, it was actually, it was 6 months, and then we all complained about it, and they brought it down to 28 days. And it's just like, you know, hang on, you get run over by a bus a month later, and you're a COVID death. And you've got all the people dying.
Yeah, and also the dying off COVID, dying with COVID, that was another one. And also if you died with, I think it was within two weeks of getting the vaccine, then they would count that as a COVID-related death.
Yes, because the vaccine hadn't worked for 2 weeks, even though all the injuries that the vaccine was causing people to die happened within 2 weeks. 2 weeks is actually, 10 days is the day most people will die from a vaccine after. You know, that's, we saw that with the MMR, the classic baby death that's been called a cot death after MMR vaccine is about 10 days. That's the thing. But let's answer your question. Would they do it again? When I saw how ineffective this was, I was like, this isn't what they're going to do. This is actually just a warm-up. This is a trial. I think what they were doing, or had a horrible suspicion of what they're doing, is they were trying all their techniques, and they're going to feed all that information into the computers to work out how people reacted, what to do, what not to do, ready for the real pandemic when people really do drop dead, which goes back to what you said before, because you said it only had to go a few steps further before they could get people terrified and get total compliance. Once people, you have a real pandemic where you do pass people dying in the street, that's when they get total control. So there could be, you know, Bill Gates has been caught basically hinting that next time there's a pandemic, people really will be scared this time.
So that's when he was smirking.
You saw it. Okay, you saw him smirking, saying it, and it's like you look at it again. He can't have just said that like on TV. But these guys, it's like the guy who I'm going to forget his name now, who owned the Trade Towers. He actually said in a TV interview that they pulled WT7. They had to pull it because of the loss that day, and pulling means demolition. So he admitted it, and he denied it after. But I think what happens with these psychopaths, a lot of them, they all hang around together, they all go out to dinner and drinks together, and they talk about it so openly, get so used to it, they forget that the rest of the population are being fooled, and they have to kind of lie in public. So would it happen again? Yeah, I think it totally could. And I think, you know, looking at Ebola, you're looking at a Marburg virus, I think it could be an Ebola spin-off. And if you look at all the pre-programming that's gone on for there, like the zombie thing's gone on for, has the zombie fashion lasted for kind of, is it 15 years? And if you look at what the zombie fashion is, or the Joker, it's people going white, it's kind of black, bleeding from the mouth, or red from the eyes. And that's basically the symptoms of Ebola. Marburg is a very similar disease. And I think they could be trying to get ready to do a disease that just wipe people out. And you know what we've also seen with the vaccination is the immune systems of people are being destroyed. You know, I think the average is seen as roughly about 30% down. So if you've managed to knock people's immune systems down, if you do Part B, like an AB component, like an epoxy, then you put out a real bug, then you're going to have a devastating effect because you've just weakened, you know, a significant section of the population. Which is, and this is such, you know, terrifying stuff I'm talking about. I really hope it's not true. And I think also our immune systems are incredibly strong. I think we're all going to fight back. There's a huge awareness. And and the other thing, when you look at all this technology, you'd be fearful of it. But why are they doing 5, 6, 7 boosters? It's because it's not working the first time. They have to do it. It's like having to shoot someone 6 times. It's not killed them the first time. They're still having to go because our immune systems are so strong. It's fighting them back. So if you're sat at home and you've had 2 jabs, if you had 1, your body can clean it out, can clean out 2, can clean out 3. By the time people have 4 or 5, they're in trouble. But, you know, so don't have any more. Warn your friends and family not to have any more, to wait. Just wait and just delve in more data, give them more information, but not to have any more. And then to look after themselves and to detox, because the body does fight all this stuff. The body knows this stuff should not be in there and will clean it out. It will clean it out.
Right. Well, I mean, that is good. I hope you're right there. I mean, I've heard about people dying with the first shot. I've also heard that a lot of people die from the third shot, the boost, yeah. what was called the booster. Yeah. And that was another thing that we could even have gone into, is that at first it was supposed to be everyone just needs 1 shot. Then they said, actually 2. You're not fully protected until you've got 2. And then that was it for a while. And then it was boosters. You've got the full 2. You're fully vaccinated, but you could do with a booster. And then it was the idea that it'll be every 6 months and whatever. Yeah. You know.
We saw that coming because some clever, you know, people investigate, people are curious, and the information came there on the French vaccine passport. They had 8 slots. So we can see they were going for 8. When you see the amount of vaccine shots that were bought, if you just take how many vaccine shots are bought, divide it by the population, you can see that they bought it from multiple lots, so they were always going to go for more. And
do you think that they had to cancel this program because Omicron developed and it wasn't as, and it gave the game away, it wasn't as dangerous as previous strains? Because that's
there's two reasons, because they pulled back in Britain at the end of January 22, didn't they? End of January 22, they pulled that third week. And that's just when they're applying all the pressure to the NHS staff. And it was a surprise when they pulled back. But a lot of the NHS staff, you know, was working with nurses groups and doctors, and just said, hold on. So all you've got to do is say no, hold on. But they're being really threatened. And, you know, they're fearing their jobs. But just said, hold on, because there's too many of you. They don't have enough workers in the NHS. There's no way they're going to force you. And I said, it's going to get to March. Sun's going to come out. And it's all over, and they're going to reverse. But they actually reversed in the third week of January, which was a surprise. And then that rippled out, basically, from London, that rippled out across the whole of Europe. And I remember saying everybody it was going to ripple out. But also, we had that legal case, and we put all that information into the Metropolitan Police in January under Mark Sexton, Lois Bayliss.
I remember working on that.
We collected that data together. We collected all the witness statements, and we basically handed evidence of mass murder to the police. And they can't get out of that because it's been multiple. It's not the old days where some paper was kind of handed in and it can be kind of burnt down, got rid of, or anything like that, because it's all been done with computers. There's multiple copies. All that information was given to the police on that day. So now they're going to be under failure to investigate murder. And goodness knows how they're coping with it. But I know also the Metropolitan Police turned around and said, there's not a case here. But other police forces around the country said, oi, show us the papers. And it was given to, and they were interested. So, and there's people within, you know, I've spoken to many people within the police who are completely awake to what's going on and realising, and the same within the armed forces. So people feel fear at home because you look out and it all looks normal. But 20% of people are not vaccinated, but that is in the police, that is in the armed services, that's everywhere. There's that amount of people awake, and all those people are working to stop this, and they're all working behind closed doors. So we can't see kind of what's going on. But there, you know, that story in New Zealand with the baby, you mentioned the blood transfusion. It all looked like they were going to get transfused blood and they were forced to. The baby was kidnapped, but the parents are happy after and smiling at the camera and kind of almost kind of winking. And the general belief is the doctors there, got compassion and switched and gave them the blood, you know, used the blood transfusion they wanted to. There's the German nurse who was it 26,000 people she gave saline solution to or something?
That rings a bell, yeah.
Yeah, oh, I can't remember the number. Don't quote me on the number. Huge amount of people. She was prosecuted and it was all, yeah, she's going to go to jail, but she was let off. So there's all, but then how many other nurses, how many other doctors kind of knew what was going on and they feared for their jobs, but just swapped the jabs over and injected people in saline? I think a hell of a lot. How many people, there was a nurse who was busted in Madrid who 2,000 people had accepted money from to give fake vaccine passports.
Oh, so that was a big thing.
Yeah. But they put that story out there. And at the moment we're going, oh my goodness me, all these other nurses and doctors have been doing that and now are going to be in trouble, because we know about the teams doing it in Britain. There are plenty of teams doing it. So those vaccination numbers aren't right on one level because they're being faked, because people inside the system are fighting back. But when that news came out in Spain, they published the names of all the celebs and they were trying to kind of shame everybody. But then people spotted who was on the list, and it was this head of one of the main pharmaceutical companies of Spain and all his family. So that everyone said, well, what the hell did he know? And what the paper said, he paid a lot because he was known to be rich. So he'd paid through the nose. The nurses extorted extra money from him. And it's like, what did he know? So that story went quiet because suddenly all the people pushing were like, hang on, we don't want people to, it's backfiring. So how many other teams were working and not being caught or have been caught but are never going to be prosecuted to work back against him, you know?
Yeah, it was amazing. I think that, again, that was another sort of big giveaway, that people, famous people, wealthy people, had actually paid to not get vaccinated, paid to fake their vaccination. I mean, yeah, you know, dead giveaway. All right, well, I mean, I'm not sure if there's anything else obviously it's a massive issue. It's very complex. It dominated for 2.5 years. And it's fascinating. And it really changed the world, I think. I think it changed society in various, multiple ways. And, you know, they said that we'll never go back to the before time. We'll never go back to 2019. And I think that so far has been borne out. You know, I don't think we'll ever go back. I think that the experience of this betrayal will remain with us, and also the majority of the population who still haven't woken up, who still think that this was all real, they can't go back to 2019 either, because their whole worldview has been changed. They don't have the same horizons that they used to have, I think, and that's as much as all the medical stuff is concerning, to say the least. I think the psychological impact of COVID, the what was done with COVID, is just as serious.
It's huge. And but just to end on a positive note, I just think there's, you know, when it's the old phoenix rising from the ashes, there's alternative health systems being set up. And we saw crypto rose out of the ashes of the last financial crisis that was invented to fight fiat currency, you know, the fraud of fiat currency. But we've got new health systems coming up now. We've got new legal systems. We've got people going back to nature, discovering old herbal medicine. There's a massive renaissance of all the things we've lost, and people discovering new values and the value, you know, values of friendships and family, because they've all been challenged and everything. And I think, you know, I see a lot of positivity coming from this. And I think they're going to lose. You know, these people have pulled this on us. You know, they're going to be on the back foot. And one of my favorite, you know, are you aware of everyone talking about those jails that were built?
The internment camps.
Yeah, the internment camps. But and everyone was terrified of them. Everyone was terrified. But I had a look at them, and they're actually quite good. The rooms in them are probably better than the rooms you get at a normal Hilton hotel by Heathrow Airport. They're actually quite impressive. And it was just a moment when I looked at it and was going, no, there's too many of us. So who are they putting in? Is it just the people that are fighting back, like you, me, and other people putting their faces up? And it's like, nah, not enough. And I suddenly realised, oh, I think it's their backup plan. I reckon it's for them. They go, if it all goes tits up, we're going to get some, we're going to build some nice prison cells that aren't too bad. So I reckon that's their plan B. When they realise that we've caught them, you know.
mm. Perhaps. Well, okay, but this has been a really good discussion. So thank you very much. I've enjoyed it. And I think that people will have learned quite a lot from it.
Well, thanks very much for having me. And grateful and really good. And I wish you luck with all the other interviews, because you're doing four a night. I mean, I'm impressed by that. Fair play to you.
Thank you. It's actually not that difficult once you get into it. But by the end of the marathon, I will be quite shattered. But
looking forward
it doesn't
to
matter. I enjoy it. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mark Plain, for appearing on Millennial.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay. I'll be back in 35 minutes with Nomos. In the meantime, bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. T-shirts and mugs and other wondrous gifts are available in the merchandise store. Impress your family, friends, colleagues, and business partners with these incredible items. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.